DPP.
Right now, headlines across the country are focused on police violence, issues of racism. Does it seem that this round of trade negotiations is going on kind of under the radar and unreported?
It really is a struggle to bring free trade into the light because it is something that those supporting have really attempted to keep hidden. I mean, the negotiations have happened in secret. It's the first trade agreement text to be kept classified from the public. As you said earlier, all we know is through WikiLeaks. So it really is difficult when we've got so much against us to bring this to light. However, at the same time, we know what kinds of impacts these free trade agreements have, and momentum really has been building over the past year, not only in the United States, but in Japan, in Malaysia, in New Zealand, in Peru, and in other countries who would be affected by the free trade agreement. And I know that I really do believe that the white supremacy that underlines police brutality here in the United States is also the kind of white supremacy and brutality that you see reflected in these detrimental and imperialist free trade agreements that really threaten local economies everywhere and make corporate rule that which comes above all else.
You mentioned Peru. Right now in Lima, there are climate talks going on in which countries from around the world are trying to come up with some sort of goal for carbon reductions. How will that interface with the Trans-Pacific Partnership if it goes through? Will the two be in conflict?
That's another really difficult aspect of these free trade agreements is that there's really huge potential for environmental protections that exist on, again, on national, state, and local levels to actually be rolled back should countries agree to the provisions contained in the TPP. Environmental groups across the United States have expressed really strong concerns around what the environmental chapter means for some of the stronger U.S. protections that we have. So at the end of the day, yes, anything that's agreed to in any climate convention or talks could be threatened by something like the TPP, which supersedes them, and which, based on all the evidence so far and the leaks of the environmental chapter so far, have not done much to ensure that we are protecting our planet and our Earth's resources.
Well, and with the far right taking both the House and the Senate this coming January, it would seem that those factions would be supportive of Fast Track. But in fact, some on the far right of the Republican Party consider the Fast Track authority to be too much executive power. Are you seeing some cross-partisan coalitions opposing this Fast Track authority?
We are indeed. At the end of the day, when you've got an agreement that's been kept secret so far, people, regardless of their political affiliations, are deeply concerned. I mean, if there's nothing to hide, why is it classified? Was one of the chants that was actually used during the march today. So absolutely, we are seeing more momentum on the far right to really challenge the issues around national sovereignty and the issues around lack of transparency. I know that for myself and some members of my family who identify as more conservative, they're really concerned about what this could mean for small businesses and what this could mean for local economy in light of the fact that multinational corporations trying to concentrate wealth among themselves are really the ones behind free trade agreements like this. So, yes, regardless of what's happened in Congress, we do still think that there is energy there, and we are working to bring all of those who are against the TPP together.
I've been speaking with Cassidy Regan. She's with Flush, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a group opposed to the TPP or Trans-Pacific Partnership that's currently under negotiation in Washington, D.C. You can find out more on the website flushthetpp.org. StopFastTrack.com. Or on the Citizens Trade Campaign, it's citizenstrade.org. Again, that's citizenstrade.org. This is Jenka Soderbergh with KBOO News In Depth.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's Underwriting Coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio, the program of, by, and for working people. My name is John Walsh. I'm one of the regular co-hosts here tonight to welcome our new Second Monday team. Our new co-hosts for this week and for every other second week of the month are Ann McDonald and Fernando Gapacin. So first off, let's just have each of them introduce themselves to you and let you know more about why they're doing this. Ann, how about you?
Hi, yeah. So I am a member of Labor's Local 483. That's how I got my start in the labor community. And I'm also on the Portland, or 15 now, Portland Steering Committee. I've been living in Portland for almost a decade, and I just love it here. There's such an active and engaging community of working folks. There's a lot to do in this town.
Good. Fernando, how about you?
Actually, I'm a retired union member, but I am a current member of the United Auto Workers, 1981, and an executive board member of Portland Jobs with Justice. I've been in the union movement and the labor movement for 50 years as an activist, and I've been a member, an activist in 13 different international, national, and regional unions. I've written books, chapters, and nearly 100 articles in journals and magazines about different aspects of the union and labor movement. And I'm thinking that there's a whole lot of work to do, and that this will, Ann and I sort of have this contrast. She's a young worker. I'm an old retired guy, and hopefully between us we'll be able to share and get insights from working people all over the country and help continue to grow this labor movement.
So I'm curious about that part of it you just mentioned. The two of you are sort of a two-person study in diversity. So we've got male and female, old and young, older and younger. Be careful of myself. But you have contrasting backgrounds and ways that people could identify you. So how did the concept come up to team up together?
We owe that to Jamie Partridge. I'm here now because Megan Hayes, who also hosts the show, she's stepping down. I know her through my local. She used to work there. And she suggested to me that I try it out. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know. I got to think about it. And then Jamie asked me. So I thought about it some more. And two people I have a lot of respect for thought I should give it a go. And I'd be good at it. How could I not? And I think, being pretty fresh to all this, I'm really pretty still jazzed. I'm excited about what is possible, all the things that we can achieve, and there's a lot happening right now. There's energy is really building up, and being a part of that is something really special. And I think so. I said I would start. I would do this show if I was teamed up with somebody who knew what they were talking about a little bit better than me. Somebody with a solid background who could school me in some things. So I was happy to meet Fernando, and this is the second or third time we've actually seen each other face to face. So it's gonna be interesting as we get to know each other a little bit better and explore the issues.
And Fernando, you have a background in writing, which is also a communications medium, but somewhat different. So was there an appeal to trying a new form of communication? Is that part of the interest for you?
Sort of. What excited me about this is the developing potential that I've seen recently. Well, recently, in the last few years. So for the better part of 50 years, I've been dealing with issues within the structure of the union movement. For most of my lifetime, we were trying to encourage the union movement to actually organize workers. When we took part in John Sweeney being elected to president of the AFL-CIO, we thought we'd reach this threshold in terms of advancing labor community efforts to grow not only the union movement, but the whole labor movement. And we've gone through a whole lot of ups and downs. We went through this ridiculous split in the AFL-CIO in 2005. And it wasn't until recently when I began with the Occupy movement and some of the regeneration of new energy coming from young people that I began again to become inspired as a labor movement person and as a trade unionist. And I'm really excited about the idea of working with Anne and us being able to create maybe that intergenerational intersection. And I saw her speak at a picnic about her work environment, and I was really excited about how people viewed this and their optimism. And it really is. It's happening throughout the country. And recently I've had a chance to experience how young people, other folks, are taking over their own communities. And more than just growing the union movement, it's about growing labor. Workers are organizing in all different kinds of ways. And Anne was sharing me some really interesting stuff about how young people are organizing themselves. And I think I want folks to know about that stuff.
Now, both of you, I think, have a focus on low-wage workers specifically. That was something that came up. So tell me more about that.
So when I moved to Portland, my first job was at Subway. And then about a year later, I had enough of that, and I got a job at the zoo working in the restaurants there. And it was supposed to be just kind of my college job, and I was going to, you know, move on, start really building a career once I graduated. I got a degree in botany. And it's a bit more challenging than getting a degree and starting a career. And I look around me, and I'm working with people who are adults, who have children, who have degrees or maybe still going to college. Everybody's paying rent. Most people have, maybe not most, I don't have any numbers or anything. A lot of us, you know, live in households. We have roommates. My joke is that if Portland is where young people go to retire, then a house full of roommates is like an assisted living facility. Like the Golden Girls, but with video games. We help each other out with food a little bit, with maybe transportation sometimes. If somebody's behind on rent or on bills, you know, we can help each other out, wait until next payday. And I see a lot of that in this town. There's the free box economy. I can't say how much stuff I've picked up and gotten rid of just through free boxing or, you know, clothing swap parties. There's, you know, people like to give handcrafted, homemade DIY gifts. You know, Portland's got a DIY culture, tool libraries, things like that. And so it's makes for great community building. It makes for opportunities for good, you know, organizing. To, you know, you're connecting with so many people, but it's really a lot of it is a way to cope with, you know, maybe you got an education so that you could get a good job, but now you got a bunch of debt and you're still making the same amount of money. you know, you can't afford to get retrained in something that is a, you know, marketable skill. So, you know, you do what you can to get by. A lot of us would like to maybe, you know, 30 years old, you know, we'd like to have our own place, but that's not really an option. It's not an entirely negative thing. And it's, you know, there's good aspects to it, but it's definitely creates a need for creative alternatives to, you know, lifestyle and urban environment, I suppose.
Fernando, how about this new structure of the low-wage economy and people who've got degrees and are at an age where maybe a couple generations ago or when we were younger, they'd be potentially already buying a home and you know, settling down. Is this a manifestation of the new unequal economy? I mean, what's the structural basis for this? How do we attack it?
Well, let me do it from this perspective. Having been in the labor movement for 50 years, I came into the labor movement at a time when people could actually get jobs in factories, they could become bus drivers, they could make a middle class living, I guess. I mean, they were able to buy a house, they were able to, and it was like generational. It was like with a high school education, you could go into a factory and you could live well. That doesn't happen now. But my interest in terms of the organization and building the power of low-wage workers, a lot of it comes from the fact that, one is that my family were farm workers. We helped to create the United Farm Worker Movement, and we were part of that. But recently, for the union that I worked for, OSCAAFT, I represented and organized low wage workers, the people who were contracted out, bus drivers and custodians. And it was remarkable, folks having union contracts and oftentimes these people being homeless. The contracts we had didn't have health care, didn't even have sick leave. And the thing is that, so when we look at the 15 now, the minimum wage, trying to make the minimum wage $15. I had proposed for my union that we unite with other unions who represented low-wage workers and create political campaigns that would do the 15 now, do the health care for all Oregon, do the sick leave act. Do all of these political campaigns that we could actually achieve if we worked together in coalition with other unions. And we could also create an organizing environment that could organize these workers, at least all of the contracted out bus drivers. But unions aren't quite ready for that yet, and we're going to have to continue to work on it. But there are people organized to try to make this happen, and this 15 Now campaign is an example of it, that we will organize regardless of whether or not the more orthodox structures take it up or not, and people like Ann are making it happen.
So Ann, tell us about the grassroots aspect of this 15 Now, for example. Tell us how this is working, what's going on.
Well, here in Portland, we started coming together about a year ago. I got involved over just this last summer, last spring, and it's really been picking up a lot of steam. We're putting out a new list of endorsers every week, it seems like. One of the latest ones was the Oregon AFL-CIO. It helps that we went around and got a bunch of their affiliates to endorse first. And the power of it is, well, no working person should live in poverty. I understand that there's a lot of people that have, you know, gone through a lot to be making, you know, $18 an hour or something like that. And I definitely, they, you know, would deserve that. There's a lot of, you know, there's not maybe a lot. There's some pushback, you know, like I've done this to, you know, make this much money. Why does this fry cook need to make $15 an hour? And the response is that fry cook is paying rent also. And if you would rather come be a fry cook, if you think it's a more, you know, fun job or something, check it out. It's not, we're working hard. It's something that goes across, you know, gender boundaries, age boundaries. It's, like most fast food workers, or low wage workers are over the age of 25. It's across race boundaries. With the Hands Up Don't Shoot, there's in Ferguson, you know, this, some of those members are saying 15, you know, poverty is a big issue. And if you're working, you shouldn't be living in poverty. It's grassroots. There's a lot of, we're still getting this ball rolling. There's a lot of ways to get involved. And, this Wednesday, 9 o'clock, come by City Hall. We're going to be there. We'll have a speaker giving a testimony. Don't Shoot Portland is also going to be there. So, you know, there's two reasons to go, two good causes. And right now, our one of our main pushes here in Portland is the Portland Fair Wage Policy. So, City of Portland made and worked with Jobs with Justice. Fernando could probably tell me how many years ago this was, to create a fair wage ordinance in Portland so that city workers, or, you know, contract workers, security guards and janitors and other workers, if they're contracted with the city, well, the city shouldn't be paying poverty wages. And right now that is... it's 10:38, I believe, in an hour with a $1.92 benefit, and so we're saying that's not really enough. That's still poverty. The city shouldn't be paying people who are turning around and then getting food stamps, for example.
Well, what's the form? So Fernando told us that at first, at least, maybe this is changing as there's more momentum building, but at first the established formal structures of the labor movement weren't willing to get out front with the raising the minimum wage to 15 campaign or similar campaigns. What has been the form of organizing that's generated the momentum that's changing this? How has 15 now proceeded to organize without that sort of formal structure for a foundation?
Community leaders and they're just you know, low wage workers in this town. I know Justin Norton Kirsten, and I'm not sure who was really the, I think Jamie Partridge might have been the core of that beginning too. Nick Caleb's campaign was kind of what really got the conversation moving in Portland. And then we've got members from SEIU, Seamus Cook, and we've got members from Sometime with Laborers. And so we've been going to union members and talking to membership, talking to leadership. So there's a lot that community groups can do. I think organized labor has got the history, the experience, the connections to really help with organizing. Nationwide, SEIU has been working with fast food workers, and convenience store workers have jumped in, and home health care workers as well. UFCW has been kind of working with Walmart workers a little bit with Our Walmart. Our Walmart is demanding 15, and you know, the right to form a union. So it's really, you know, different working groups everywhere are kind of picking up and you know, taking that demand. And it's such a straightforward thing too. The numbers I've heard, you know, for it's a really a low ball estimate for what a living wage is in this area, just anywhere really. And if wages had gone up with productivity, it would be over $20 an hour. So we think it's a fair number. It's definitely an achievable number. San Francisco has done it most recently. Seattle has done it. County workers here in Multnomah County have won 15. So it's, you know, groups are picking it up everywhere. And, you know, each victory just kind of keeps spurring it on, keeps it going. And we've got chapters popping up now, 15 now chapters nationwide. So we're forming a statewide steering committee. And because Oregon has a preemption law, Portland can't set a different minimum wage than the rest of the state. No municipality can do that. So then, okay, fine, we'll take it statewide. We were, you know, working to some extent. We don't like preemption. We would like to see that go away too. But it's really focused our goal a little bit more so on building a statewide 15 now movement.
There've also been a number of referenda in various states on minimum wages, whether not 15, I don't think specifically, but at least raising minimum wages at the state level. In the most recent election, that was one of the few things where progressive measures actually did reasonably well. Fernando, do you think long run it's going to be stronger organizing this way, starting from grassroots and then getting the formal structures on board versus the more top-down approach if unions had taken the lead in the first place?
I think that unions, other institutions in this society, often respond and make adjustments based on external pressure. And, you know, one of the groups that has been playing a leading role in terms of creating that kind of pressure is Portland Jobs with Justice. Other groups like Healthcare for All Oregon are putting pressure, trying to create legislation to get universal health care, single payer health care in the state of Oregon. And unions are having to be coaxed and perhaps educated to understand why they should be taking these kinds of issues up more vigorously. They do have the experience and the resources, but other organizations like Enlace is another nonprofit that represents low-wage workers, and there are dozens of organizations that take this stuff up. Enlace, by the way, is having a huge fundraiser to celebrate the retirement of Peter Cervantes Gauchi on February 4th at SEIU 49. So that's a plug for an event where people can come out and help to build this low-wage workers movement. Also, Healthcare for All Oregon is having a major mobilization for February 11th at the state capitol. And we hope that we'll be able to get 10,000 people there and get a lot of union support.
One comment that struck me before when Ann was talking about living situations now is that the opportunities for organizing that emerge from a more communal form of living, in a way, are a throwback to the days when people lived in apartment buildings in cities and saw each other all the time, couldn't help it, just walking up and down the steps and going in and out of the building, versus the suburban sprawl where people have their own detached house and may not even know their neighbors. So sometimes organizing grows out of circumstances, objective circumstances in some sense, but perhaps it's necessary as organizers to find where those circumstances exist and make the most of them. So in the case of young workers who don't have enough to live in a detached suburban house, finding the organizing opportunity that does exist in that and using that as a strength, you know, finding the positive aspect of that situation as far as changing the material reality. And maybe for us older folks, it's a way to recognize, again, something that we knew before and know how to work with when it is present.
Well, I think it's vital that we create what I call communities of solidarity. Other people have written about it. But for instance, Jobs with Justice brings together a lot of the different groups organizing, and it creates a place and a space where these different organizations and groups can strategize and make things happen. it just has to be done in a more conscious way. And there's a number of examples throughout the country, and hopefully in the months to come we'll get a chance to discuss some of these things.
And we're about out of time for tonight, so people will have to tune in again to hear you talk more about it. But tonight, for the first time on Labor Radio, you've heard Ann McDonald and Fernando Gapacin, our new co-hosts for the second Monday of each month. The engineer tonight for the show is Danielle Parks. Thank you, Danielle. I'm John Walsh, and thank you for listening to Labor Radio. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can all